Welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Features Podcast. Today we have a fabulous guest who, for some strange reason, keeps coming back.
Her I new like film.
Oh, she likes us. Look at that. I have a friend. Isn't that nice? Her film, Curse of Hob House, you know where you'll find out at the end. And she's here to discuss it. Julianne Block's back. Thank you for coming back. Welcome.
Well, it's a Sunday afternoon. There's nothing better to do than to talk to you.
Well, we all can't really go anywhere. There's still, well, at least here there's stuff open. If I need to go out, I can actually go out and do something.
Well, shops are closed mostly, but they are opening up like this week, I think, like slowly in Germany.
See,
again.
That makes me happy. My gym opened 2 weeks ago. I'm back to being excited.
Yay.
So I've sat with you. I think we've done every film you've done, if I'm correct. I don't think I've missed anything.
A couple of short films, but I think we did every feature.
Okay. This to me, this is your jam. Like, you seemed into this. I definitely see new camera angles from you. I see a more intensity I haven't seen in any other film. So is this your thing, horror? Or is this one appealed to you because you wrote it with somebody?
That is really a difficult question. People come back to me and say, is horror your thing? And I would, well, obviously, I like horror, otherwise I wouldn't do a horror film. But then again, I also would consider The Curse of Hob House rather a horror drama of sorts. So it's not kind of a slasher horror. It's not kind of like all gory, bloody, which was also came out negative in some of the reviews. And yeah, well, truth to tell, I think if you're really into like super gore, The Curse of Hob House might not be the right film for you. But the thing is, like, tension and having also horror in relationships between people in a way, that is something which I think is interesting. I mean, hence also the other films I've done, psychological thrillers. That said, I think also things change. So, for example, right now, I'm not really looking to do more hardcore horror stuff. So I'm very interested to do like a children's project, possibly due to my son. But it'll be an adventure. So that might be something which all of them have in common of sorts.
So let's back up. I've seen your first film, and I would say as a director, you've outdone yourself in this film. I see a new you, if is what I'm trying to say. Now, what do you think you've learned from your first previous films to now? I definitely see different directing styles in this one. Maybe it's the type of film you built, but I think it's more of a confidence in your shots.
The Curse of Hob House has something which the other films, I think, I'm not sure if this kind of like equals confidence in the shots, but the thing is, like, for example, in Three Lives, there's much more of my personal backstory in it. So it's kind of, it's a tough watch because it's something which was something I needed to work on, a trauma, if you want to say so. With Eight Remains, the pre-production time was very brief. So there were, I think, Eight Remains is a very layered film in a way. With this one, in the wake of like Eight Remains, Three Lives, and now The Curse of Hob's House, we really wanted to tell a story, and which I wanted to do before. But this one, well, the pandemic came after, so we didn't really kind of put our personal experiences in it that we say, well, that's something we really need to do. So for us, it was more kind of like, okay, what do we really like about the horror genre and what do we want to make? So we actually looked into classics and tried to make a piece which somehow reflects great horror classics we like, which also kind of can be seen positive or negative. So for some it's boring, for others it's great.
So you still didn't answer my question. I'm discussing, are you more confident as a director? I mean, you look like you knew you wanted this shot. I do think you definitely do different angles. I think you take things from a way that you didn't used to do. I find that closeness and claustrophobic stuff that I saw in the original films is now gone. Is that just a directing style, or you're more confident in using those shots?
Well, you definitely grow as director with each film. So yes, I'm more confident as director now. This second thing is, this film has different things in it, which kind of also require, I think, different camera angles. So I think as more you do, as more you can choose and think about camera angles in the sense of, okay, this is what I want to tell. This is a story I want to tell. So how do I tell it? That said, for example, claustrophobic is not necessarily what I had in mind sometimes, like when shooting this film. Hence, that might be a reason. So, for example, like if you compare Three Lives, there we wanted to go into war-style movies, all handheld and stuff like this. I still like handheld a lot, kind of. Like, so there is also a switch in this film, The Curse of Obsidian. You can see that at some point, the handheld style takes over. So in the beginning, it's more static, and then like it becomes more handheld as more people, like as more the action starts, the characters start getting into the action of the story. So from that perspective, yes, I'm a little bit reluctant to say, okay, this is this masterpiece, because I really had not enough time to make everything I wanted to do, because we have 18 shooting days and I had more shooting days with the other films. And well, you never should kind of speak badly about your own work in a way, but I think there were a lot of things in terms of action, which I wanted to actually even do better. And I lacked the time. So that was, we actually had to cut down 6 pages during the shoot while we were shooting this because of certain things we didn't anticipate. All in all, I like what's the result, but then again, also like I would know several things I totally would do different if I had the chance again. So what Wolf and I did, Wolf, the writer, and also he produced this with me, we said, okay, well, the next time we want more action. So let's shoot, like let's write one which has more action. So we wrote like Hobbs House and Necromancer, which is kind of like a sequel to this one 3 years after, which is a lot more action adventure-y than classic horror haunted house style.
Okay. I mean, what happens with those 6 pages? I mean, you're shooting and you pull out 6 pages. So I'm going to ask, because I want to know, where were the 6 pages? I would guess probably near the end.
Like everywhere. So like basically, okay, like what got pulled out was certain zombie action. There was more zombie action in the beginning. And then like you cut down on also dramatic scenes, meaning like you might shave off here and there. So it's not kind of 6 pages straight into the bin. So it's kind of half a page here, half a page there. So you manage this scene, but you can't really actually, you know, like basically you have 5 pages and you know you can shoot 4.5. So you just see like, okay, cut a little bit of dialogue here and a bit there. And it's painful. I mean, it's not what you want to do during the shoot, but you have to get creative then.
Yeah, I could see, I would argue some of it might have been the relationship between the two sisters. I do think there could have been a little bit more there. And I think it was more of a time thing. I didn't know you cut pages, but I would say it was just a time thing. I know you wanted to give me more there. And I felt you were trying to as a filmmaker, and I just felt that was a little short at times. But I don't think that was because of the writing. I think it was just a time issue. You're like, okay, we're going to do this much time. We got to take some of that out. And I think that's where you probably stole stuff from. At least I would say that's where it came from.
That is some of it. And like, just to elaborate how this happened. So we had this gorgeous location, and we got like a good deal to shoot there, and had just to agree to, and we agreed to shoot around their common, their normal events. They do weddings and business lunches and wakes and this and that. And I knew of 2 events which were scheduled during the time we shot this. So I said, I can do a feature in 18 days, but only if you can really finish one location after the next. So, you know, like you shoot one. And then when we came there, and obviously also very low budget, we came there 2 days prior to the shoot, so it's not like a huge amount of pre-production time, almost none. I found out that they actually had booked 16 events in 18 days. So basically we couldn't finish one set. We had to rebuild, I think, most sets 3 times. And obviously the crew was absolutely understaffed to actually cope with this. And then, like, I remember we shoot a very intense scene, and right next door, they play the favorite songs from this guy who just died. And then we just had to stop, you know, like, our recording, because we could hear his favorite songs, and then we have to wait, and they make a break so we can actually record our dialogue. It was crazy. We had to move the green room twice, which is really painful for production if you don't have, like, your makeup space and, like, the costume space, and you have to move everything. That costs a lot of time. And then, like, also, like, it was sometimes really absurd. There was also a children's birthday, like this little girl turned 4, and her parents came with, like, some guy who was dressed up like Harry Potter and looked like a total creep, and they had, like, unicorns, like real horses with little horns, and then they had all these, like, Harry Potter flags everywhere, and, like, an ice wagon somehow, and everything mixed together, and then our zombies were running right in between in the middle of it, and I was like, this is, it's a film in itself.
I think there is a film there. I think you should totally use that for your next film. I think you got it all in one shot. So we did discuss the house, which I was going to get to later. Let's start right there. What is this house? Where is it? And obviously people can go see it. So let's get that out.
Yep. King's Weston is in Bristol. Somewhere in the middle of Bristol, actually. You can go and visit it. So there's a cafe in the basement, and but people live there. So, you know, like, it's also it's not just kind of for viewing and things like, as I said, like events, but people actually live there. So that was another problem. I mean, obviously, like, we knew about this, but we were only allowed to shoot until 8 p.m. So you have, like, these events. So you could say, well, then just shoot at night. You want night anyway. Why not do this? But we couldn't actually make any noise inside the house after 8 p.m. to not disturb the citizens or the residents. Sorry. And, well, I think it's just an old mansion. And the owner now, as said, like, he rents out some of it. So he himself lives in it. And then, like, you can just kind of rent it for your whatever event, like if you want to marry or awake or whatever. It's a beautiful house.
It is. I'm just going back to your horror setup. I'm just thinking, if we wanted those zombies, they could just eat all the children. They could eat the creepy Harry Potter guy. Think about it. It's all there for you.
I know. So I was just kind of taken a bit by surprise. Otherwise, I would have just chased them through the gardens and said, like,
I think you should have got eat them. Go get the Harry Potter guy's numbers. You can take him out next film.
He possibly will never listen. And if so, like, you know, just work on your outfit, man. That was really creepy.
Okay. When you're doing a film, I noticed something different. You had animation at the beginning of this one, which I've not seen from you before. So tell me why animation.
We wanted to give the entire zombie undead angle a different spin. So we didn't want a pandemic, and therefore you have backstory. And this is just something we came up with and obviously thought while doing it, okay, sneaky, there are, like, some other films in there, so we can go back and shoot the origin story, like, in the Middle Ages, if someone gives us a lot of money, or, like, we can shoot a set, like, the sequel. And there's a lot of stuff in there which can be used for further productions. So we just had fun. And we do like those interests, Wolf and I, that is. And I got in touch with this fantastic illustrator who then came up with those drawings. And I think they're really gorgeous. So it was also kind of like I met him. And then, like, we started writing The Curse of Hop's House. And I was thinking, why don't we just try that? Let's try something new.
So you seem like the type of person, everybody you meet, you're like collecting. Oh, they can do this. They can do that. Because I'm convinced a Harry Potter guy is showing up somewhere. So is that your style at times when you meet new people? You're like, oh, you're an animator. Great. You're a boom guy. Great. I'll make a note of that. And just in your head, when you're creating things, you add them in. You may not see them for 2 years. You may not see them for 6 months. You may not have spoken to them. But the way I'm hearing you think, you always seem to be thinking of your next project. And as soon as it comes up, you're adding those pieces in your head.
I think there's some truth in it. Yeah, I can't deny it. And for this illustrator, I do have to admit that I think he contacted me. He wanted to see if we can work together. So, you know, like, the thing is, obviously, also, he just kind of randomly sent me stuff. He was reaching out, I think. But normally, yes. I also know that usually I contact people if I want something. So I'm very terrible. So Wolf is, from the two of us, he's a guy who's just kind of keeping in touch for the reason of keeping in touch. I have to admit, I don't call people just for talking to them.
I somehow knew that. I don't know why, but I did.
I think we talked about this before.
Probably. Who knows? The narrator at the thing. Again, this is a totally different style of film. The narrator sets my tone for this film. Right off the top, you give me a nice narrator. You relax me before you rip me apart later. Was that the style you were after?
Well, I think a good story also has a good narrator, or can have a good narrator. So in that instance, it just fit the bill. As I said, like, we wanted to go back to certain classics and we were looking into different styles done with horror classics of the 70s and 80s and also recent ones we liked. So, and we thought, okay, let's just kind of dive into it. That's possibly the biggest difference. We were talking in the beginning that we really said, like, okay, we want to make a specific style of film and try certain things rather than having a story we just need to get out of the system very urgently, in a way, if that makes sense.
It does, totally. Now, the music, it's very subtle. It's not overpowering at any time. You can hear it. You definitely know it's there. But again, I find it very calming. And then again, you sucked me in. Was that the whole plan, just to just put a vacuum on people and make them come into the world?
Well, obviously, like, if that's how you felt when you watched the movie, I would say that's great.
It was. That's in my notes. Okay. I like how you switch from the animation to the house. Very seamless. Like, it wasn't jarring. A lot of independent films, I find, don't have that. You know what I mean? But you seem to have that nice blend. Did you work on that? Did you tell them exactly, I want to go seamlessly into the house?
First of all, I can't remember. I do know exactly which shot you're talking about, but I cannot remember if I actually said to the drone operator, exactly this is what I need to actually blend into the animation, or if it was, okay, I need a shot which blends into the animation. We're looking at the shots I got and then kind of told the animator to move in that direction because I knew I had this shot. So I can't really remember which was first, like, in that. Obviously, like, I knew I somehow need to go from one to the other. So
here's a question. When you have a drone operator, how much work do you do with the drone operator? Do you tell them what you're looking for? Obviously, I was shot. But are you standing beside them while they're shooting, or do you look at it later? So you're doing something else at this time.
Ideally, you should actually stand next to him and work with him. In this case, I think I was just kind of sending them off, like just doing something because, as I said, we were so tight on time that I was happy, like, for everyone who could just do, like, something by themselves.
So, okay, again, so when you have a makeup artist, are you giving them direction or saying you trust they know what they're doing? I mean, the boom guy, you trust, you know what he's doing. I mean, you have 18 days, you said. So as a director in an independent film, how much direction do you have to give them? Like, how much time do you have? Or do you just trust the people you hire?
Mixture of both. You try to give as much directions as you can, and then you have to trust. For example, if there's something in costume or makeup you can't really, or you don't really like 100%, there might not be time to change it. I do admit there are specific areas where if I had all the time in the world, I would have gone for a second shot. But then it was okay enough for me to say, okay, let's run with it. I mean, they're like, as I said, like, everyone under the pressure they were did a fantastic job. So, you know, like, it's also kind of, I think, making a balance of what can you achieve and what screws the film. So from that perspective, there's nothing in it where I would say this is completely not what I wanted, but I'm, as said, like, if we had at least 5 more days, I think some of it could have been elevated a little, but that's life and that's fine. So, you know, like, this, like, every filmmaker possibly says that about every film they do, that afterwards they, this could have been better. So they all did a good job and they were listening to what I told them.
Would you chalk that up to indie filmmaking, that you have to accept it's okay, it's fine, it's not 100% what I wanted, I just have to accept it because I have a time constraint? That's not a choice you have to think. You can't reshoot, I guess, is what I'm saying. If you're somewhat happy, you just go, okay, that's fine. I'm going to go with this.
I mean, you work towards the result most as perfect as you can get it. And then you have to make choices. I'm not saying that you always make the right choices, but the worst is to not make a choice, because that is something I can for sure say that kills the film. If you cannot make the choice and you cannot make a decision, then usually your film is dead.
Fair enough. That actually is a good point out there. Night shooting. I mean, obviously inside you have lights and stuff. I mean, outside, I'm not saying you don't have lights, but in independent film production, you probably don't have as much lights as you need. What are some of the challenges you had on this? I mean, this place looks very tree-like. I mean, obviously, it has a beautiful lawn. I can see that. Just somebody's kept that. But again, you're shooting on this lawn, and you have things coming out of forests, and it's dark. So can you walk me through the lighting and how you shoot that?
The forest is not that huge. Actually, like if you come out of the house, you have one huge lawn to one side, one huge lawn to the other side, and then parking space on the other two sides. So there is not really a huge forest. It's really in the middle of the city. So if you think it's a huge forest, that's good, because basically it was right next to it. There were just kind of a couple of trees. There was like kind of a stretch, maybe 5 meters width, like which had the trees. And so we were kind of just actually pulling the cables from inside the house up to the trees. And then we were just kind of like saying, okay, this is the angle we can shoot. And so now let's make it look like forest.
You're hiding in the dark. It's kind of hard. I can't really see lighting beyond those bushes. So as a viewer, when you're watching that, you're only going to see the dark, because you're going to only let me see as a director saying, okay, this is all they're going to see. And you're letting my brain work the rest of it. I mean, you've set the tail out of time that the graveyards are here. These zombies are going to come out. So I'm thinking somewhere in deep, dark forest somewhere, like on a country estate. But no, you're telling me it's downtown London or Bristol's London.
Bristol.
So I should go there. So, I mean, again, as a viewer, if you don't know where this location is, it could be anywhere.
That was the entire idea behind it. And I mean, obviously also when our protagonist drives up to the location, obviously we also have this transition to tell the story that's in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it's part of the entire story. Like if you want to have a horror house, there shouldn't be anyone close by. But I also have to admit, we have visual effects where they actually kind of took out the parking lot and stuff like that.
Aha, you cheated me. I see how it works.
I will tell the visual effects guys, they will be very happy.
Yeah, I didn't notice. So that was good. That's very good. The graveyard. How do we cheat on the graveyard? Is it a real graveyard? I figured no. I would say no, it's not. But
it's not.
Again, you're always shooting at night. It's hard for me to figure these things out.
So the thing is, a graveyard. There was one shooting day. The very early beginning, there's a scene where this guy gets more or less like ripped in parts, like on the graveyard. This was also due to the fact that we were lacking gore after the 18 days. So we decided, okay, let's just kind of push in a bit more. And that was really just like three tombstones we got like from this was a company in Wales, and they have like all kind of production design stuff. So they are out of styrofoam. And we just got them. We just put them on a farm. Like we were able to use like part of a farm. So this was like just a field. So we put them on a field. That's it. That's all graveyard.
So I want to back this up. So you phone a production company and go, hey, I need some gravestones. They sell them to you. I got that part.
They lend them. So, you know, they have them on stock. So it's like production design. You know, I'm lacking the English word. Like companies who have a huge pile of stuff you might need.
Yeah, no, completely understand. Prop house. We would use it in English, and yes, we call it a prop house. Okay. Exactly. I didn't know if that translates to German at all. I have no idea. Okay. So you don't get to keep anything then. It all goes back.
It all goes back.
Now, I'm going to ask another question just because I figured I should know the answer. So it's a rental, like a week rental, day rental, hour rental.
Usually depends. These ones we got for 2 days because like we were shooting one day and one day is kind of like get them and return.
And okay, is that just FedEx back to them? Is that UPS back or do they come and get them?
No, you actually, we need to go and get them. So we send a production assistant who's kind of picking them up and bringing them back.
Sorry, weird questions. I always want to know with independent cinema how these things work.
Usually, I mean, it's interesting because usually it's not necessarily a production assistant because they usually are off as soon as the shoot is done. So in this case, I think our first AD was living nearby. So he actually took them when he was going home and just kind of like brought them back.
So this may be an issue. You're shooting in this gigantic house that obviously hosts banquets, weddings, crazy Harry Potter birthdays. Did you have to tone down the lights, like dim them a lot when you're shooting? Because, I mean, you have a lot of shots in there, and it's dim. It's not really lighted light. So how was your issue with that? Obviously, did you bring the lights down? Did you use tarps? How did you block that out?
The lights in the house are not the problem. The big windows can be. So what you usually do is kind of you cover the windows so you can control the light. So it's more like about controlling the light instead of dimming it down. Dimming down is not the problem. You can always do this like in post and grade. But the problem is if you have huge windows and you have the sun kind of going around, because that's something you can't control, and then the lights look different. If you shoot the entire day in the morning, it comes in from the left, evening from the right, or something like this. So you want to get rid of this, and usually you have like these huge black fabric you use to just black out the windows.
So working with blood is one of my favorite things to always discuss. You have a lot of blood in this film. Not a huge amount, of course, but there's blood. As a director, you really don't have a shot to take another take. I know that on independent film. You can't fix it. So what drives you nuts most about blood?
Usually the lack of it. Like you need more to have it look the same amount on screen as you want it. And then the second thing is that it dries so quickly. So it's kind of sometimes, you know, like the it's... if you shoot for several hours, your actor, if he or she's bloody, needs to look wet, bloody several hours. And that is kind of a makeup issue because you constantly need, for example, like if she has her trousers, there's a blood stain and it's fresh. So it just keeps fresh for 30 minutes or so. And then you have to actually kind of touch it up again. And then obviously you have to pay attention that it looks exactly the same. So you don't want kind of like different blood stains jumping all over. I think that's possibly it, which was actually kind of something in Three Lives, that was even more of an issue of sorts.
Wow. So you're throwing me back to an interview. So you're telling me I'm bad as an interview. I should have discussed blood and Three Lives. Okay. I got it. The dust jacket. Where did that come from?
Sorry, which jacket?
The dust jacket of the Hobbs House book.
That is that the cover or
yes, the cover. Sorry, it's called the dust jacket for us. So.
Sorry, we made it.
Were there more than one made, or just the one?
I think just the one. Really, well, usually you have two or three at least, kind of like to make sure that you have something if it's kind of. If it gets ripped apart or something. I think inside was something interesting, like a physics book, or I don't know exactly what it was.
So Miss Alex's house is different than the Hobbs house, or is it the same house?
Same house.
Okay,
well,
so just...
If you say Hobbs house, I mean, her, like in the story, it's called Hobbs house, but the guy who built it called it Hobbs house because he kind of flattened the house of the witcher who lived there before.
Fair enough. So who stole the Walkman? Who has that sitting at home?
That should be Wolf, actually.
Okay.
I don't have it.
So it's not, you don't allow to have it. So when you're shooting a film, before you go in, do you decide what shot techniques you're going to use ahead of time? Or sometimes you don't know? I mean, obviously, I'm sure in your head you storyboard.
Let's put it this way. For these type of film, I usually don't really storyboard up front. I have a shot list and like we agree on a general style. Meaning, for example, do we go with dolly shots? or very static or handheld, stuff like this. So what's kind of like the feel we want to give? So this is something I discussed with the director of photography up front. Since like so many things change last minute sometimes, you know, like you want to shoot this scene, but then you have to shoot this scene because basically that room is taken or something like this. I think that's why I found it easier for me to just stay kind of open-minded enough to not have it all storyboarded, because I might have to change everything entirely. So like to actually shoot something. So this doesn't work. Let's do this. And then I know I need a wide shot. I need really to focus on that specific movement. And if basically the characters do this, this is important for the scene. So this is what I somehow need to work out.
So you use the usage of outdoors for the passage of time. Was that your cheat to get the story moving so we weren't dragged down by anything?
Oh, well, this is also something, I mean, it's a very common thing, like done in a lot of series and films as well, like just to give a passage of time and stuff. And it's something where B-roll footage comes in. So usually like that's not necessarily planned. And here's a fun fact. We didn't have enough time for B-roll. So actually there are like two or three Three Lives shots in there, because in Three Lives, we had a full afternoon of actually shooting stuff in the forest. And then my editor goes, like, who also cut like Three Lives, she said, can I use some of this? Because I remember there was one afternoon where the lead lady had to go to hospital and we had the full crew and didn't know what to do like with the time. So we were just going off and shooting stuff. So that came in handy, actually.
That's kind of funny. So your design of the zombies, who designs how they're going to look? Is that you? Is that the makeup artist? Is it both of you collaborating?
Several people collaborating. Costume, makeup, which is special effects makeup. In this case, also visual effects after. And then obviously like also what we want to convey. So we had a zombie trainer. He's actually like, he's a super funny dude. He's he goes by the name of Zombie Trainer in the UK. And I think is one of the leading people if it comes to actually tell people how to move like a zombie. This is insane to watch him. He can go like, he's actually ex-military, and he then, I think he's not working in the military anymore. And he said, what can he do with all this, skills, his physical skills he has. And then, you know, like you tell him, okay, go zombie, and he starts shrieking and moving, and he freaks you out totally. Like it's nuts, like to watch him. And he told like some of our actors. And there's something else which is interesting. It's not easy for all actors like to be a zombie. So you know, like they like we realized that this is a really a special skill set. So, and the blue eyes, that doesn't sound too good for a production, but they weren't planned. So this was something we came up after, because like, I just didn't find the zombies scary enough. And obviously there's a lot you can do more. If you really have money, you know, like you can really invest more into contacts and costume and stuff like that. And everyone did a great job, but we were short on time and money. So, and then, those blue eyes were something where I said, okay, let's give them something special. And it works with a curse and everything. So this is what we did.
So last thing I want to go over is working with somebody else in writing. And I think, how did you work with Wolf? Whose idea did it start with? Or did you guys just have a cup of coffee and it came up? Help me out.
Usually it's more a cup of coffee. We come out with the idea. We actually do the outline together. So we have brainstorming sessions like a writer's room. And in this case, he then goes off and writes a script based on that. And then I'm more or less like working as the one nagging and saying like, okay, can we change this? I don't know how to do this. And I was very lucky also that he obviously is as into it and was on set, because I think these kind of cutting out 6 pages thing wouldn't have worked if he hadn't done it on set on the spot and knew the entire story also inside out, so he could fix holes and stuff.
Okay, now it's time for your favorite part, your fun questions. How would you like to be killed in a horror film?
I think freezing to death. And that only can happen somewhere in the Arctic, so somewhere with a really grand landscape, because otherwise it's not really worth it. And just kind of so I can see, because I find this super fascinating.
I don't know if you like sports. So what's your favorite sport to watch, if you have one?
I actually don't like to watch sports at all. I find it boring to watch. I have a favorite sport, but I think, I don't know, just kind of watching other people do it is not really interesting.
Fair enough. Now, we know you're a world traveler. You've lived all over the world. Is there one country you've never been to and always said you're going to go to?
That's a hard question because I've been through a lot of countries since I was working on a cruise ship. So I was really kind of 50 plus countries or something I've seen. Mongolia. I haven't been to Mongolia and really would like to see it.
Now, before we let you go, I'm going to give you a big shot here. You can tell them about everything. Tell them where to find all your films. Maybe you have a website. This is your forum. Go.
All right. So first of all the films you can check out on j-blockbuster.com. So, and you can see in which country where they are available. So we revamped our website a couple of months ago. So you can now find based on your country, which films to watch where. The Curse of Hobbs House is out 8th of March. As we record this, that means tomorrow.
Oh, wow. I'm on top of something for once.
So let's see when you publish this. But anyway, so for UK, that's obviously our home territory. That's a big deal. Shame we can't have a theatrical release in these times. But anyway, so go and watch it. So it's out already since December last year in North America. You can watch it in the general outlets, stream it. You can buy it as DVD. Same goes for the UK starting 8th of March. And yeah, I think that's about it. Like the social media channels, all J Blockbuster. So that goes for Instagram, J Blockbuster Movies, for Facebook, Twitter. So just come and connect.
Thank you for your time as always and have a great day.
You too. Thank you so much.